Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment. This is your nav, John Lash, recording on April 14th, 2013. And this is not a nav briefing, but an audio commentary that is going out with crew notes number 22. And the title of these notes is The Central Riddle of Correction. Now, as I looked at GaiaSpora.org, I noticed that I sent out the last edition of crew notes, number 21, entitled Testing Channel 16, at the beginning of October 2012. So it has been quite a few months since you've received any crew notes from me. And these have indeed been decisive months in the process of this experiment. So I'm glad to be back with some written notes. Eventually, the notes come around toward the end to the main topic, the central riddle. On the way to that topic, I'm discussing a number of other matters that have come up in the last few days and various points and themes and questions and issues that I consider to be relevant to our current place in this journey. So once again, thank you all for being on board. Thank you for writing me. Please understand that if I don't respond to crew email, it's simply because I can't, as much as I would like to, but I do read the email and it benefits me and often assists me in shaping and directing my thoughts. I am going to cover a couple of mails, actually, in the audio commentary and the written commentary in these crew notes. So today is the fourth day of the Chinnamasta shift. It commenced, actually, on the 11th of April, which was a Thursday. And 2 days later, from the upper terrace at Ambergane House, in the company of Kundry, I was able to observe the very, very thin sunset crescent in the ram, standing before the satanic head of Cetus. So we are most definitely in a Chinnamasta shift. And I would say, however, that on this occasion, there's an opportunity to experience the benevolent side of Chinnamasta. I have more to say about that in nav briefing number 58. So I am pretty much in parallel right now, this evening, this Sunday evening, in Andalusia, recording in parallel the audio commentary for crew notes 22 and nav briefing number 58. So there's a crossover between these two recordings, between these two talks. And if you go to nav briefing 58, which is entitled FGS 3.0, then there you will hear my further comments on the Chinnamasta shift. There I will explain my realization of yesterday evening when I stepped out on my terrace here in the Turton's modest palace and saw the celestial anchor above the house and the crescent moon of the Chinnamasta shift in the form of a satellite dish that was perfectly oriented to Jupiter. So in nav briefing 58, I give a further account of that moment and the realization that I had as I stood there looking up at the glorious spectacle of the crescent moon approaching the celestial anchor. So here we are, proceeding more or less in my audio commentary in the order of the written notes. These are the long-awaited notes on the theme I initially proposed some months ago, the central riddle of correction. And I stated that riddle in provisional syntax at the conclusion of NB number 57, The Power of the Narrative. I'd like to kick off these crew notes by covering an email I received today and presenting my response to the email in the body of this text. The mail came from Australia, from someone named John, who says, I've been listening to your briefings, catching up to the most recent, etc., etc. I have a question, if you have the time. What do you know about DMT entities? My friend and I have a feeling they might be Gaian Dakinis, and I'm sure I have also seen Archons while having a bad DMT trip. In a trip, love will manifest, loving, beautiful entities showing you how to create universes in their hands, and fear will manifest horrible, fearful entities, which I thought could possibly be Archons. Of course, to explain these dimensions with human language will always fall short, but in my beautiful trip turned bad, the Archons I saw were like Boeing 707 jet-sized hyperdimensional cockroaches flying through space, dripping slime, haha. One took me inside its vessel, and it felt like being raped by tentacles, like literally going to hell. But it seems fairly obvious to me, DMT opens your third eye, pineal gland, and takes you to higher dimensions. Was just wondering if you have any knowledge of this and how it relates to your understanding. Thanks for your time and wisdom, John. Okay, this email warrants a close and detailed response. And there is a factor of synchronicity at play here as well. Synchronicity involves my longtime friend and colleague, Graham Hancock. It so happens that some of the points raised in this email from Australia resonate closely to the dialogue I am currently pursuing with Graham Hancock. And in fact, it was one of the events that marked the tonal shift, if you might call it that, that I underwent during my encounter with Dumavati, was to recover and reestablish my connection with Graham Hancock, who is a British writer and researcher of some renown, as you may well know. If you don't know about Graham, you might want to go and look him up a little bit and research him a little. He's written a number of books. And I'll return to the subject of Graham and to the significance of my reconnection with him after I go through my response to the email that I just read. So here is the response of the nav. I'll read the text in the crew notes and add some oral commentary as it seems fit. I would define the DMT entities, so-called, as inorganic animations of Brownian motion. They constitute a kind of swill, or to be more precise, I would say, they constitute an appearance that presents itself to the human mind out of a kind of swill in the Dhimma. And that is to say, out of an elementary turbulence that is stirred up by human attention and momentarily assumes forms projected on it by human interest. So, my definition of DMT entities, a subject of enormous and vast discussion in the entheogenic genre, by the way, would be they are inorganic animations, momentary inorganic animations of Brownian motion. So what is Brownian motion? Well, here I take directly from Wikipedia, which I would deem to be more or less reliable in this case. Brownian motion, or paidesis, Greek for leaping, is the presumably random moving of particles suspended in a fluid, or gas, resulting from their bombardment by fast-moving atoms or molecules in the gas or liquid. The term Brownian motion can also refer to the mathematical model used to describe such random movements, which is often called a particle theory. Okay, audio commentary. This presumably random motion of particles causing them to leap around in an excited manner, similar to the behavior of the entities who appear in a DMT flash, is due to, in the case of the DMT flash, to the bombardment of those particles, that is to say, the swill of the Dhimma, not by fast-moving atoms, but by the impact of human attention itself. Therefore, you have in the DMT entities actual experimental and experiential proof that the power of the first attention of the human animal can cause and configure events in a material medium. But the material medium is not the medium of the sensorially perceived natural world. It is the medium of the substrate of elementary matter that belongs to the composition of the sensory world. So it is a subsensory perception of matter, where that is the theater of the DMT entities. Continuing with a Wikipedia entry. In 1827, the botanist Robert Brown, looking through a microscope at particles found in pollen grains in water, noted that the particles moved through the water, but was not able to determine the mechanisms that caused this motion. Atoms and molecules have long been theorized as the constituents of matter, and many decades later, Albert Einstein published a paper in 1905 that explained in precise detail how the motion that Brown had observed was a result of the pollen being moved by individual water molecules. This explanation of Brownian motion served as definitive confirmation that atoms and molecules actually exist and was further verified experimentally by Jean Perrin in 1908. Perrin was awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1926 for his work on the discontinuous structure of matter. Einstein had received the award 5 years earlier for his services to theoretical physics, with specific citation of different research, right? The direction of the force of atomic bombardment is constantly changing, and at different times the particle is hit more on one side than another, leading to the seemingly random nature of the motion. This transport phenomenon is named after Robert Brown, hence Brownian motion. And just add here a couple of more points which I find interesting. The mathematical model of Brownian motion has a few real-world applications. For instance, stock market fluctuations are often cited, although Benoit Mandelbrot rejected its applicability to stock price movements, in part because they are discontinuous. Now, this is important little detail because it shows that Brownian motion and the fluctuations that can be mathematically computed at the particle level do not have the continuous properties of fractal interactions. Fractal interactions of nature at the elementary level and at the level of sensory nature in the terrestrial atmosphere and at the levels of cosmic materiality in the atmosphere and in outer space, those beautiful and self-similar, self-replicating fractal processes are distinct from the Brownian motion, which belongs to the Dhimma, which is chaotic and discontinuous. Brownian motion, the phenomenon of particle agitation in the Dhimma, as it were, is subject to the first attention of human animals, as I will explain. But the fractality of the processes of nature at all levels is evidence of the organizing power of the first attention of an aeon. Human beings do not have that degree of capacity in their first attention, but the aeon Sophia does. So I have explained and described in my rendition of the Sophianic vision narrative that the impact of the aeon Sophia upon the Dhimma was initially to produce a fractal explosion in the Dhimma. It organized the Dhimma fractally, and out of that fractal explosion came the anomalous species of the Archons. And of course, you'll find all this in metahistory.org. And if you want to review it, you can go to the link included here. That would be the essay, Alien Dreaming, in the material on the Sophianic vision story on metahistory.org. Okay, continuing with the last section of this Wikipedia entry. Brownian motion is among the simplest of the continuous time stochastic or probabilistic processes, and it is a limit of both simpler and more complicated stochastic processes. This universality is closely related to the universality of the normal distribution. In both cases, it is often mathematical convenience rather than the accuracy of the models that motivates their use. This is because Brownian motion, whose time derivative is everywhere infinite, is an idealized approximation to actual random physical processes, which always have a finite time scale, end quote. This is the kind of gobbledygook and scientific theoretical double talk that you find typical in science or in anyone who follows the paradigm of the false sciences of the 20th century, such as particle theory, atomic theory, relativity theory, quantum mechanics, string theory, and so forth. Nevertheless, you can tease out of this language, or the Nawal would dare to tease out of this language, a little bit of something that makes more sense and can be verified. Here you have the word stochastic. To my knowledge, that was the first word that was applied back in the, I guess it would be 70s, with the emergence of chaos theory. It was called stochastic theory, that being the adjective to describe turbulent and chaotic processes in nature. Then it became chaos theory, and now I believe it's called complexity theory. So again, you see that there is a mingling here. You know, there's a very, very difficult problem inherited from the time of Planck and Einstein. And unfortunately, this problem is a double problem because it is a problem introduced by the two paradigms of relativity theory from Einstein and quantum mechanics from Planck, which are both fallacious theories. And the problem is, how do you reconcile and combine two fallacious theories? That is called the problem of the unified field theory, which we inherited from the beginning of the 20th century. So what is the problem of the unified field theory? Well, it turned out that scientists working in that genre at the beginning of the 20th century discovered that the 10 tensor equations used by Einstein to establish special and general relativity, although they work perfectly as a self-referential mathematical model, could not explain certain processes at the microcosmic level. They explained macrocosmic, or they gave a description, which is fallacious, of macrocosmic phenomena, but not microcosmic. And so scientists looked to Planck and quantum mechanics for the explanation of how matter behaves on the microcosmic level, and to Einstein for how it behaved on a macrocosmic level, and then they operating strictly within the framework of these two fallacious theories, which are fallacious on their own terms, they created the impossible conundrum of finding a unified field theory which would combine and reconcile both models. And this confusion permeates most thought in physics still today. And you can see how it's evident in this paragraph, because on the one hand, they're talking about properties of the macrocosmic structure of the universe, and that is to say the stochastic properties seen in chaos theory and complexity theory, including the beauties of fractal organization. Then they're talking about, well, wait a minute, these same properties and processes exhibited in the complexity of the universe in its fractal beauty do not occur and cannot be detected or mapped or computed accurately on the microcosmic level, even though, as they admit here, the mathematical convenience of computing them comes from the models and not from the actual phenomenon. You know, mathematics has taken over physics, and mathematical models get in the way of observation of nature. So the bottom line of what I'm getting to here is that Brownian motion belongs to the dema, or the dema, however you want to call it. Let's call it the dema. The dense elementary matter arrays. The Gnostics called this area of Hyle, H-Y-L-E, primordial matter. They called it the realm of shadow and the kenoma, meaning the realm of finite possibility, whereas the pleroma is the realm of infinite possibility. And scientists today cannot clearly discern the difference between those two realms. So the error in this last statement is that Brownian motion, quote, whose time derivative is everywhere infinite, is just a mathematical fiction. The time derivative, which appears to be infinite in Brownian motion, is a property of the dema, that is to say that it is the kenoma or kenoma. It is not infinite. The kenoma is not infinite. It is the realm of finite potential on the finite time scale. The laws of the pleroma are the laws of infinite potential and infinite time, and they manifest in the fractal organization of the matter in the realm of finite potential and finite time. And this dualistic model from the Gnostic cosmology works a lot better and makes a lot more sense than this gibberish and double talk that you find in physics. Okay, enough on that digression. Back to the DMT entities. What do I have to say about them? Can they be compared to archons on the one hand? Can they be compared to the Gaian Dakinis on the other? No. DMT entities are elementals. They are not organic beings, and they are not to be confused with the Gaian Dakinis, which, although they are also not organic in the strict sense, partake of the composition of the organic elements of the atmosphere, that is to say, atmospheric chemistry. Now consider the composition of the livable atmosphere of the Earth that supports organic life. And this is what is generally defined as the composition of dry air. A little over 78% nitrogen, a little over 20% oxygen, just under 1% argon, 0.039% carbon dioxide and small amounts of other gases, and then air also contains a variable amount of water vapor. Note here, by the way, that the noble gas, as it's called, argon, is present in the livable atmosphere to the extent of just under 1%. And that is considerably higher than carbon dioxide. So there's a lot more argon in the air you're breathing right now than there is carbon dioxide. In fact, if you calculate it, I think it comes to 24 times. There's 24 times more concentration of argon in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide, which is such a rage these days, you know, carbon dioxide considered to be such an important factor in the in these bogus theories of anthropogenic global warming. So I won't expound at this moment on the properties of these chemical components of the atmosphere, these atmospheric gases, as they refer to Gaia's own consciousness. I will simply point out what I have said before. The Gaian Dakinis are labile fractures in the nitrogen composite of the livable, breathable atmosphere. These fractures occur where the life force of the Aeon Sophia erupts due to hyper-excitation of interactivity with human animals who observe the eruptions. And a little note here on this term, labile or lability. It's a term that Wilhelm Reich used most significantly in the function of the orgasm and other of his groundbreaking works on biophysics. Lability is a term used to describe a relatively unstable or transient chemical species. As a general example, if a molecule exists in a particular conformation for a short lifetime before adopting a lower energy conformation, the former molecular structure is said to have high lability. The term also sometimes refers to reactivity. For instance, a complex that quickly reaches equilibrium in solution is said to be labile with respect to that solution. So, translating it into Gaian biophysics, human animals and all the progeny of the planetary animal mother move about the surface of the Earth not merely inhabiting the physical landscape, but also inhabiting the atmosphere. And the mystery concerning how we actually inhabit the atmosphere is a deep one. That was the subject of inquiry and investigation among those genuine adepts of alchemy who arose in the Middle Ages, and who were, in one respect or another, you might suppose, associated with the diaspora of the mystery schools. Back in the mid-80s, when I presented the course on alchemy and psychoecology in Santa Fe, I used the term atmospheric mystics to describe these individuals of the medieval period. And I pointed out that prior to the definitions we currently have of chemistry and atmospheric chemistry, for example, the definition of nitrogen produced by the alchemist von Helmont early in the 17th century, I believe, prior to these scientific definitions of today, the alchemists of the medieval period were interactive with processes in the atmosphere, and they did not have merely definitions of the biochemical properties of the atmosphere, but they had direct experiences of it. Hence, they could experience the process of photosynthesis directly, intuitively, empathically, and somatically. and they represented this experience in the alchemical imagery of the green lion eating the sun. That is not just an image of photosynthesis, but it is also a record of those experimental biophysicists who detected photosynthesis by the direct apprehension of their minds and senses. Now, among those atmospheric mystics of that time, a number of them were able to perceive the organic light. And the code names for the organic light in these medieval alchemical texts and their later derivatives are numerous. The white stone, the philosopher's stone, the Sophic hydrolith, that's a made-up term. The alchemists made up many terms, as you know. Consider this term, Sophic hydrolith. Well, first of all, hydrolith means literally water stone. So it's describing something that has the property of stone, that is to say, substantiality or materiality, but also has the property of water, that is to say, it flows. So it's like a flowing stone. So it's like a lava, or like porous foam, or liquid marble, a hydrolith. And Sophic, of course, is from the root Sophia. So it's the water stone of wisdom, another way of describing the organic light. Now, the Dakini fractures seen in the atmosphere, in the sky, are not productions in the organic light. They are actually productions of Sophia's force in the atmosphere, in the livable, breathable, open atmosphere. That's an important distinction to bear in mind. Also bear in mind that the organic light itself does not appear as a luminosity that rays through the atmosphere. One of the most mysterious properties of the organic light is that it wells up within material mass. It does not radiate through the apparent empty space of the atmosphere. Bear that in mind. So, returning to the subject of the Dakini fractures, as I call them, and distinguishing them from DMT entities. The Dakini fractures exemplify the physical reality of what medical scientists call labile effect, without knowing actually what they're talking about. I define this phenomenon of labile effect as life communicating with itself across natural boundaries of self-definition. By contrast, the DMT entities are excitations of the dema produced by the intensity of human observing. They might be called daemonoid entities, known in Kabbalah as elementals or klipoth, very famous and notorious term in Kabbalistic magic, Q-L-I-P-H-O-T-H. Kabbalists, alchemists, and would-be magicians who experimented with ritual magic often encountered these same entities. Why? Because the practices of ritual magic all involve intensification of human intention, of human attention, excuse me, specifically the first attention, the power of observing and calculating and repeating. For example, when a medieval practitioner of magic would inscribe on the ground a magical design, a mandala, for calling up some entity, the magician would inscribe the design or sigil of that particular entity or demon or angel, and then it has, of course, a a fixed geometric aspect. And so the magician used the power of the first attention to concentrate his or her mind on that sigil, which is an invoking device. Then perhaps would follow in the process of the ritual the repetition of some name or some syllable, the chanting or repeating of something. Also the calculating of the particular moment of the day, of the particular hour of the planet, and the planetary angles relative to the horizon when that ritual was performed. All of those activities are part of the framework of a ritual act of invocation of a demon or angel. And all of them are actions of the first attention. And so in performing those actions, the alchemist actually amplified and heightened the power of the first attention. And it was the power of the first attention that actually invoked or produced the demonic entity or angelic entity, who then presented itself to the consciousness of that practitioner. You see, that's how it worked. For an aeon such as Sophia, the power of observation follows Heisenberg's rule. The act of observing alters the process being observed. And it goes further than mere alteration. Oh, yes, indeed, it goes a lot further. For the application of the power of the first attention by an aeon actually produces material effects and spontaneous events. In the GNE, as you know, we regularly observe the moments when the Aeon Sophia applies her first attention to the experiment here underway on Earth. How do we do that? Well, by attending to the moments of lunar perigee in the constellations. In most instances, as I've noted, we cannot observe what she is actually doing with her first attention at that moment. But at best, we may infer what she is doing. And as the process unfolds, we may also come to see the effects of what she is doing by the hits of the first attention, given that we have prepared our minds to detect the evidence when the evidence arises. It's like a crime scene. If you're a trained detective and you go into a crime scene, you're trained to see the evidence. A person who is not so trained could wander around the crime scene and find evidence, stand in front of the evidence, and not know they are seeing evidence. So our process of observing the moments of the perigee hits in the constellation prepares us for the evidence of what the Aeon Sophia is doing when she makes those hits. And this is a forensic technique consistent with telestic shamanism. The power of the first attention of a human animal contains the aeonic power in a minute dose, a reverse magnification of that power that is not ordinarily adequate to produce immediate material effects or alterations in ongoing processes. By reverse modification, I mean, obviously, the power of the first attention is magnified or demagnified down to a minute level of efficacy. However, the introduction of autogenic training, later called biofeedback technique, by Schultz in 1932 opened a pathway toward experimentation with the immediate material power of the first attention and verification of its effects. Under the effects of DMT, the power of the first attention is momentarily heightened to a level that human animals cannot normally reach or sustain. The result is the power of observation of the subject under the influence of DMT immediately plunges to the Dema level, like a sharp blade cutting a membrane or boundary of perception. DMT trips are not telestic, so they proceed with no preset intention to direct the faculties of heightened awareness. Nor could an intention be sustained in the steep and sudden shift of awareness that DMT produces. Under this influence, the mind goes immediately, instantaneously, to the Dhimma, which is the elementary level of material composition, subsensory. But then you observe there the activity of the Dhimma, which is a swill of Brownian motion, but manifesting in the form of hyperactive troll-like entities, which are actually produced by the power of the first attention. Thus, DMT exhibits the occult capacity of human awareness to manifest and modify material processes in the cosmos at the microcosmic level. The Gaya Dakinis are not of this kind of microcosmic interactive phenomena. The Gaya Dakinis appear in the subliminal zone where the tonal borders on the Nahual. The daemonoids appear in the subsensory zone of Haile, or elementary matter. The daemonoids take consistent form due to the consistent tendency of the first attention of human animals to find order and organization wherever they look. Thus, these DMT entities appear to be the technicians and engineers who produce this order. And in a certain respect, they are so, in a certain respect, in a certain manner. The swill of the Dhimma has its own properties of attention, rather like a robotic awareness or thermostatic functions, but not a living, self-conscious kind of attention. What do I mean by thermostatic attention? Well, you have a device, a mechanical device on the wall of your living room, which is a thermostat. And when the temperature drops below a certain level where the thermostat has been set, the device pays attention to the heat. It pays attention to the heat drop below that level, and it sends a signal to turn on the furnace. When the heat in the room rises to a certain preset level, the thermostatic device pays attention to the heat reaching that level and sends a signal to the furnace to turn off. So you can say that the thermostat on your wall pays attention. In the same way, the daemonoid entities in the swill pay attention, but it's a robotic kind of attention. They are barely capable of interactivity, but the Gayan Dakinis revel in it and invite it ardently. The purpose of the DMT molecule is to act like a primer or a priming substance. That is to say, it's a chemical added to a process to mesh or coordinate different components in the process, especially where differences of material density come into play. One example of a primer is a chemical that a painter can add to the oil colors so that the oil painting dries more rapidly. So, if you're painting in oils and you're applying layers of oil paint to a canvas, it will take a certain amount of time to dry in interaction. The oil paints will take a certain amount of time to dry in interaction with the atmosphere. But if you add a certain primer or chemical, that interaction is enhanced. This is what the DMT molecule does in regard to the interaction between human attention and the swill in the Dhimma. Another example, I don't know how well this will work in your minds, but another example is this. Suppose that you had a model of an animal, carved a model of an animal such as a mouse out of soapstone, and you drop this little model mouse into a chemical solution like a thin gelatine. It might just float in the gelatine, submerged. But if there is to be some interaction between the mouse and its chemical environment, rather than merely a passive state of suspension, you would have to introduce a primer, a second chemical, that seats or situates the soapstone carving in the gelatine and allows it to behave in certain ways rather than just float there without animation. Now, DMT has the basic biological function of a primer in the swill, such that it facilitates seating the human body, the human organism, into the inorganic substrate of materiality. Recall that on this planet, due to the peculiarities of this experiment, there is what scientists call abiogenesis. That is to say, living organic processes are seeded within an inorganic substrate, a matrix of inorganic chemistry, so-called. This being so, there has to be a priming substance, or lubrication, if you will, that facilitates the seeding of living organisms into the matrix or substrate of inorganic life. DMT serves this function biologically and biochemically. It acts like a lubricant, and that is why it saturates the human fetus up to the 7th week of gestation. Have you read about that? Go read about that. Saturation of DMT in the fetus. You'll find that Rick Strassman brings up that point in his book, The Spirit Molecule, about which I'll have more to say a bit further on here. In its first weeks of formation, the human fetus must establish the initial conditions of organic life as an organism, while in close interface with the conditions of inorganic chemistry, both within and without the organism. Once this adaptation is accomplished, the saturation of DMT drops off sharply. DMT remains in the organism as a vestigial chemical. It's concentrated in a vestigial organ, the pineal gland, and which is of no vast importance for consciousness. In that respect, DMT has been immensely overrated, in my humble opinion. By contrast, the Gayan Dakinis work actively with ATP, that is adenosine triphosphate, and that is a metabolic chemical that deserves perhaps the high regard universally given to DMT. Proof that DMT is not a hugely contributive chemical for heightened awareness in the human animal could be seen in the fact that DMT entities cannot sustain narrative, and they are in fact antipathetic to time-bound realizations of order and organization. Like the cogs and springs in the minute mechanism of a watch, they have no connection to what you actually read on the face of the watch, that is to say, the linear phases of time, and everything that you can infer from the changing juxtaposition of the hands of the watch. The three hands of the watch, minute, hour, and second, present a number of different configurations, and the human mind can read these, but the cogs and springs in the mechanism of the watch cannot read them from inside. The DMT entities cannot read from inside the processes where they operate. They support the mechanism of the watch, as it were, but they do not partake in its so-called higher functions. Therefore, I consider it to be delusional or demential, if I might coin that term. Demential has DMT in it. I consider it demential, or at the very least, a serious detour to a dead end, to infer or claim that DMT flashes represent a path of higher consciousness. They do not, to my mind, represent a genuine shamanic or telestic path. The demonoids are trolls and techies, pixies or pixelated dema, and they are nothing but fleeting figures in the swill. They are elementaries, or clip-off. They cannot instruct coherently, and they are incapable of sustaining narratives. They appear to know cosmic secrets, but encountering them happens so quickly that there is no time for them to deliver what they know. Oh, really? Is that what you think? Well, that is what many subjects of DNA trance presume or assume. They assume that these trolls and these pixies are spilling over with information. They want to tell us how the whole universe works. They want to give you the secrets of the universe so rapidly. And somehow they don't manage to do that. But this is a delusional effect. In fact, they have nothing of the sort to deliver. Human subjects in the DMT trance assume they do. The closest they get to giving instruction would be evident in baffling and paradoxical aphorisms captured in split-second glimpses by the human mind. For instance, the fragments of Heraclitus. As you may know, Terence McKenna pointed out that one and possibly other fragments from the Greek philosopher Heraclitus had been the result of DMT flashes. But of course, it is the human mind itself that produces these aphorisms, not the demonoids who merely provide the stimulus for them. So in summary, and to be as precise as I can be, these demonoids or daemonoids are actually produced by the act of observation of the human mind peering into the dema. They only exist as they are observed, hence their instantaneous and fleeting character, which is so baffling. They are figures produced by the first attention of the human animal when that attention impacts the dema, and in turn, the activity of the dema, its Brownian motion, irritates or agitates the first attention. You could say you see the DMT entities because you have fairy dust in your eyes. And fairy dust sprinkled in your mind by the DMT chemical rush produces fairies. Fairies are produced from the agitation of the fairy dust. This is the origin and nature of those DMT trolls. Now, at the conclusion of my written notes on this passage, I mentioned the failure, drop-off, or dead-end of Strassman's experiments with the spirit molecule, and that is, I would say, that can be taken to prove the point I'm making here. And what is the point I'm making? The point I'm making is that no coherent and long-term realizations of the physics of this planet and of the universe at large can come out of the DMT experience. And as far as I know, nothing as such has come. The DMT experience has largely been, in my assessment of the literature, and testimony of other people compared with my own sessions, the DMT experience is largely of a visual impact. There is a sound impact as well, sense of hearing a cosmic sound, as if you were standing under an enormous bell, the dome of an enormous bell. You hear the cosmic sound. And then there are vivid visual impressions. And I believe that these visual impressions of the DMA, DMT flash have been taken up by many artists, and that they have been carried over into so-called visionary or psychedelic art inspired by DMT. But if you read the book The Spirit Molecule by Rick Strassman, you will find that the conclusion of his experiments and the follow-up of his experiments were, in his own words, quite disappointing. In some cases, the subjects were able to carry forward the content of their DMT experience in a positive way, and they were able to say, yeah, it affected my life, it changed my consciousness, it did something good for me that had lasting effects. I'm not particularly convinced by this testimony because it doesn't have any real or specific bearing. It's just a general, it was expressed, the subjects of the experiment expressed it in a general way. Bear in mind also that the experiments done by Rick Strassman in New Mexico, I believe, occurred in clinical setting, in the laboratory and in rooms with equipment around and in a sterile environment or in an environment of clinical activities with people in white coats and clipboards coming and going. And as far as I'm concerned, any psychedelic or entheogenic experiment in that kind of setting would be not productive of life-enhancing results. But anyway, that is how these experiments were conducted. In the last chapters at the end of his book, I don't have it here with me because I don't have any of my books around anymore, but at the end of his book, Strassman talks about following up some years later to the subjects of the experiment, and he concludes, correct me if I'm wrong, that on the whole, apart from some vague and general beneficial effects that were claimed, DMT does not lead to a profound and lasting transformation of consciousness, nor does it lead into a meaningful and purposeful direction to take one's life. Also, it does not have the lasting quality of a religious experience such as described by Alan Watts in The Joyous Cosmology, or such as was described by Aldous Huxley and other early pioneers using psilocybin and mescaline and LSD. The DMT experience is a flash of some kind of extraordinary other world journey. But subjects do not come back from that journey with lasting effects and lasting results, or with an enhanced wisdom and sense of purpose, as far as I know. And so I believe that Strassman himself admitted at the end of his book a certain sense of disappointment with these experiments. I would say that that disappointment is due to the nature of the DMT molecule itself, that it is not meant to be taken in that particular form for the purposes of genuine telestic shamanism. It doesn't work for the practice of genuine telestic shamanism, as far as I know. And also, I just might add that having come off that experiment to which he dedicated a good part of his life and upon which he established his professional career, Strassman then turned around some time later and went off on, I don't know what to call it, he went into a process whereby He is now attempting to explore the realm of biblical prophecy in order to show something. I don't know what. In order to show that somehow, I don't know, biblical prophecy is an aspect of entheogenic illumination, something like that. It appears that Strassman, if I may make this allusion, returned to his Jewish roots by this fascination with biblical prophecy. And all I can say is that any kind of prophecy, biblical or otherwise, is symptomatic of mental disease. Prophets and people who wish to be prophets can be classified, according to my mindset, as mental defectives. There is nothing good in prophecy. Prophecy is not an expression of the proper use of human imagination. And so it makes sense to me in a way that Strassman would have gone from these failed experiments with DMT into an even greater failure, some attempt to legitimate or valorize biblical prophecy. And that is a really serious mistake and a huge, huge waste of time. So here I am at the 1 hour mark, and I'm only halfway through the crew notes, so I will present the audio commentary in two parts. I'll conclude the first part here and pick up the notes with the Dumavati encounter in the second part, in the second recording of the audio commentary for these crew notes.